We are going to introduce a new guest. Never before on Cats in Our Laps, a new guest. Her name is Susan D. Matley, and I'll read about her briefly, and then we'll talk to her, and she's going to read to us as well. She writes contemporary fantasy and or mythology, including the Small G and the Big G series. On Wolf Singer Publications, her short stories have appeared in Thema, Literary Journal, Glass Fire Magazine, Dark Pages, and many other print and online anthologies. She lives in southeastern Washington State, the land of wheat, wine, and windmills, with her four-legged kids, which we're going to talk about. The G series begins with Small G City, then Big G City, and not finally any longer, but finally in my bag here, beyond Big G City. Not longer, because I think there's another one coming. Susan was the Arts Foundation of the Mid-Columbia Writer of the Month for this month. Right now, she is wearing her laurels. She's in front of me. Her laurels are wrapped around her forehead and the back of her head. That's the month of December. Congratulations, Susan Matley. And she's been, and, ooh, I don't want to say the rest of this. I was wondering where those words had gone. I thought I had read them before, but I haven't. Susan Matley, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Phil.
Yeah, it's good to see you. You know, I don't think we've ever met before, but I certainly have read your books and I've known about you for many years.
Oh, very good.
It's a delight to have you. So you have three readings, from one from each of your books.
And I do.
I think that you've told me that in total they amount to about 12 minutes.
Yes.
Yes. So let us have a couple questions and let us have three readings. And well, these gods of yours, there's big G gods, there's small G gods. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? I mean, aren't gods gods?
Well, not really. I mean, you know how we are, us mortals. We have heads of state. We have royal families, those kinds of things. Those are the big G kind of gods. The world of the books is one where the Greek pantheon in particular is running our world from behind the scenes, because we don't know as much as we think we do about how things work. And we're pretty good at hurting ourselves if we don't have their interventions. So Zeus has organized a corporation called Olympus Inc. And he and his wife Hera and his siblings Poseidon and so on, they are big G's, and then their offspring are big G's as well. The small G's are more like civil servants. They're like your basic weather gods. There's a pretty temperamental rain goddess in the first book who makes it rain like crazy in Seattle, even though it's 90 degrees, it suddenly goes to a rainstorm because she's having a bad day. So it's a stratification. It's a corporate thing that's kind of like heads of state and civil service.
And some of the small G gods, I believe, are structurelings.
Yes.
And
yes.
I had never encountered the term structurelings, so I had to learn of it from your first book. But I think for our listeners, we need an explanation.
Oh, happy to oblige. A structureling is an immortal being who has been educated and trained to disperse their molecules in an under-engineered architectural structure to reinforce it. And the primary structureling who's involved in Small G City is a fella named Ralph, and he has his molecules dispersed in the Alaskan Way Viaduct. Now, I must point out, the viaduct is gone now, but Ralph was in there from its inception in 1953. It's very important. There's another structureling named Clifford. He's holding up the space needles. So the next time you go into these big, ambitious structures, you just might want to think a little bit about who's holding it up for you.
Well, and I was wondering, with respect to Ralph, the Alaskan Way Viaduct was torn down. Some of it was dumped out into Elliott Bay, I think, and some of it was put into the Battery Street Tunnel. Does that mean that Ralph's molecules are at sea in some cases and buried underneath the surface of Seattle in others?
Well, now, if you haven't read the book, it would be kind of giving away the ending.
That is true.
I can tell you that Ralph has gone on to other structureling work. he's had quite a career. He was one of the components that became the Great Wall of China. He held up the Roman Colosseum. He had a really good gig as London Bridge before it got moved to Arizona, but he made Zeus mad. So being put in the viaduct was kind of a punishment. And not only that, he was put so he was facing the buildings, not the bay and the view. So Ralph's had a real tough time in the viaduct. And in fact, his is the existential crisis that's about ready to destroy Seattle. So
yeah, I was wondering, you mentioned London Bridge, and the song London Bridge is Falling Down seems to have a new meaning for me now. But could you, your first reading is from, I think, Small G City.
It is from Small G.
Yeah, so let's, would you please read to us?
Certainly. Now, this person's point of view in this scene, his name is David Bernstein, and he's a barista at an espresso cart in downtown Seattle, where much of the action takes place. And David's been noticing some very strange things going on, and some people who have unusual abilities keep crossing his path. The tall girl in pinstripes, she said her name was Veronica, twisted David's will with telekinetic powers. It had to be something like that, since it was happening again. Helpless, he obeyed as she guided his hand to the whole milk and extra shots of chocolate for her tall, skinny double mocha with cinnamon. She stared at him when he handed her the steaming cup, the steel in her eyes softening after she sipped her drink and repeated what she'd said yesterday. Perfect, just like they make it at home. David mastered his jangled nerves and leaped into the conversational abyss. So where is that? Home, I mean. She licked a blob of milk foam off her upper lip. Grease, more or less. Her smile revealed strong, white teeth. David studied the counter as he wiped it down, avoiding her analytical gaze. What brings you to Seattle? Corporate restructure, she said. He looked up, startled. Dark eyes flashed angrily at him as if he didn't have the right to be surprised. No offense intended, he blurted. You just look kind of young for that sort of thing. Her gaze cooled back to analytical. He could almost see her brain shuffling information like a beefed up hard drive. Her face brightened, indicating what his Psych 101 professor had called an aha moment. Of course, she said with a choppy laugh. I mean, I'm working on a case study about corporate restructure for my dissertation. Cool that you get to study abroad, David said, wondering if he could qualify for a program like that if he went back to college and really applied himself. Are you going for a master's? That would be a thesis, and I'm done with that. The dissertation is for my doctoral degree, she said with amused patience. I might look young for my age, but I'm 26. Wow, David said, impressed. I bet you'll find a job anywhere you want when you graduate. He cast a sheepish glance at the espresso machine. Veronica sighed, her forehead furrowed. Dad has different plans for me. He runs the family business and he wants me to take over when he retires. Bummer. My dad's a CPA and he wants me to be one too. David rolled his eyes up toward the striped awning, down to the counter and back to Veronica. Guess I showed him. She practically spit out a mouthful of mocha when she started laughing. Her glee took him by surprise and he laughed too. It sounds like we have a lot in common, she said, her smile reaching her eyes. If you need any pointers on rebellion, I'm your go-to guy, he said, grinning. Veronica took out another five and stuffed it in the tip jar. Thank you, David. It was thrilling to hear her speak his name, though of course she knew it from the use your bean plastic-coated name tag pinned to his chest. For a nanosecond, he thought to ask her when she got off work or researching or whatever she was doing, but logic prevailed. What would she want with a guy who was 6 years younger, uneducated, and several inches shorter than she was? Instead, he gave her a brief nod and said, thank you, David watched Veronica walk away, shoulders square, dark hair cascading down her back. Yesterday she'd seemed scary, but now he realized she was smart and stately. She waited at the corner of 3rd and Madison, shifting her weight from one sandaled foot to the other as she gazed over traffic at the notoriously slow "Don't Walk" sign. Like a lot of people who waited at that corner, she lifted a hand and pointed an index finger at the signal, which changed immediately. Great timing, he guessed.
So we've met David Bernstein and we have met Veronica. We meet them in, I'm just going to say, book one. Book two, we learn a lot more about them. And I can see that there is some risk in giving away more than we want to give away here. In fact, I would say that your trio of books puts me entirely in a bit of a quandary because you have so many surprises in the character development that you want to keep as surprises until one gets to the right place in the book. So I'm trying to think of some general questions.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, well, the Big G Gods here, I wrote this, maybe it'll work. The Big G Gods are not content to write about on clouds. They have business to do, and it seems to me that they're getting involved in purposeful activities for the betterment of humankind, even though they are not human. And in book two, does that cookies have to come out of the oven?
No, that is an old, it's a replica of a regulator clock like they used to have in railway stations.
I see.
It chimes on the hour and the half hour.
Yeah, well, it was close. At any rate, the purpose to which the gods are going to put themselves, at least some of them who care, in book two, which is, I can't remember the title. Tell me the title.
Big G City.
That's the one. It's just by my elbow, but I was too lazy to reach for it. What are they trying to accomplish, especially one character whom you can identify if you want to?
Well, Veronica has in fact succeeded Zeus as CEO of Olympus Inc. And one of the issues in this book is Zeus is having difficulty figuring out who he is now that he's not the CEO of Olympus Inc. anymore. So he's struggling with, I guess, what I would call his feminine side and different aspects of his being. Veronica is hot on the trail of totally reworking many aspects of the corporation. And there's something special about being CEO of Olympus Inc., where Zeus has handed down something called the power. It's a supernatural power that has to be very carefully used, or it could create some very bad consequences. But Veronica has been calling on the power to address issues with her siblings, who are all employed by Olympus Inc., but nobody's doing their job. And she's given them reviews and she's given them progress plans, and everybody's ignored her. So she's been using a little bit of the power, and the very difficult one that she's having to overcome very last is her brother Ares, who is the god of war. And he's been deliberately inciting wars all over the globe for millennia. And it's not only bloodthirsty and terrible for the humans, but it's very expensive for Olympus Inc. to underwrite these things. So she is now on the eve of confronting Ares. And I chose this scene in particular because Veronica has a cat, and his name is Bill Gates Jr. And since the program is Cats in Our Laps, I thought Bill Gates Jr. should be in the scene as well.
Please.
Okay. Veronica got home late, as usual. She'd particularly wanted to have everything in the CEO office in order before she left work, with notes for Cleo, Hermes, and Clifford as to the status of important unfinished projects they might need to take over in case of, well, she wasn't sure exactly, but the bad feeling in the pit of her stomach wouldn't go away. Wow! Bill Gates Jr. greeted her the instant she opened the condo door. Hi, buddy. She reached down to scratch his head, but felt too weary to pick him up for a cuddle. The soft pad of tufted feet followed her to the kitchen. She set the deli bag of polenta and goat cheese, her go-to comfort foods, on the counter. Veronica took the opened but untasted bottle of Sauvignon Blanc from the refrigerator and retrieved a wine glass and a dinner plate from the cupboard. But she didn't want to eat. Not yet. Maybe not tonight. "Wow!" the cat implored. "Okay, pretty boy." She followed him to the kitty habitat, smiled for the first time today as his indignant hindquarters stomped ahead. Veronica replenished the food and water and cleaned his box. The room was in the same disastrous condition it had been in on Sunday, but cleaning it seemed like a task for Sisyphus. The curtains, the leaning cat post, the vacuuming would have to come later. Veronica shivered. Tomorrow she'd face the most frightening task of her life. She'd need to use the power to take Ares down. And why wouldn't it extract a heavy payment to overcome this vicious mess? Dad could and should have handled the problem long ago, but it was too late to place blame, pointless to feel anger. She'd taken the job with open, if inexperienced, eyes. Veronica paced to her bedroom, switched on the light, searched the drawers of her desk for an envelope and a piece of paper to write on. She sat at the desk and wrote instructions for the care of Bill Gates, Jr. How much and when to feed him, the name of his veterinarian. The instructions, tucked into the envelope and addressed to Elethea, were propped against a sickly-looking begonia on the kitchen counter. She cast a disinterested eye at the dinner makings, knew she should eat, but couldn't make herself, not yet. Veronica wandered from room to room, looking at a few things she'd collected to make her condo at home, not much really, a few books and a couple of wall hangings. The bust of Queen Elizabeth I in the hallway wore its usual grave stare. Veronica wondered how many times this mortal woman had faced peril and the chance of death. Athena had known Elizabeth. Veronica meant to ask her about their acquaintance when the crisis had passed. At least, unlike Elizabeth, she was immortal and didn't have to fear death. Veronica wondered grimly if death wasn't the worst of it. Sighing, she returned to the kitchen and poured herself a glass of wine. It wouldn't help to pass another night without food or sleep, to arrive at tomorrow's meeting place more weak and exhausted than she felt right now. Tomorrow's schedule, which she'd reviewed just before leaving the office, showed an appointment with Clifford Essex and Jim Smith at 3 p.m. Evidence life would march on after the confrontation with Ares. Athena and Aphrodite would face Ares with her, and with the force of the power. Sickened with a momentary blinding headache, Veronica set her glass down so abruptly the stem broke. The voice of the power had been quiet today. That was what frightened her most of all.
And I don't want to talk about the power. Ooh, is that Bill?
No, he's kind of an inspiration for Bill Gates Jr. His name is Friday, June the 6th. Because that's when he was rescued. It was Friday, June the 6th, and he's 15 years old. He's a very handsome tuxedo cat, as you can see, but the people listening can't see.
And he has white paws as well.
He has white paws as well, yes, and he weighs about 17 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's about the same weight as Champ, who is our cat. Big boys indeed. Yes. We are looking at 20 minutes to the hour of 10 o'clock. We have another book we have not asked you to read from yet, and we will do that. But I do want to ask you, this looks to me like an ongoing saga, because we go from small G city to big G city to beyond big G city. And I know that whatever is next is on its way or has gone to the publisher. So do you intend to be continuing this on and on and on, or is there possibly going to be a conclusion somewhere into the future?
There might be a conclusion in volume 5, Volume 4, its working title is Crisis in Big G City. And it goes pretty heavily into trying to solve climate change.
So that's introduced, actually, the matter of addressing climate change is introduced in Beyond Big G City, and
yes.
Then it continues on. So read yes. to us again, please. And you have two more cats. If you want to bring them forward, that would be okay, too.
Oh, okay. Well, it's kind of up to them.
I see. So
this
Bill.
This is their house, their rules, you know.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now this is a slightly lighter plot thread in Beyond Big G City. There are some serious ones too, but this has to do with the ongoing aggression between Aphrodite, the goddess of love and romance, and Hera, the goddess of marriage. They have two competing industries. Not only that, Hera is Aphrodite's mother-in-law. And so this has to do with them and their conflict, but told through two other people. Candy Smith had been reticent to accept Monique's invitation to meet at the Isle of Ill coffee house. And not only because she detested sitting on beanbag chairs, Monique worked for the enemy. Monique had said it was purely an exploratory meeting and might benefit Candy's marriage and the media work. But how could that be true when Candy's boss and Monique's boss were immortal enemies? Intrigued, Candy said yes. Monique was waiting. She looked stern and ready to discuss business in her navy blue wool toga, her dark hair pulled back severely and clipped with a gold barrette at the nape of her neck. If Candy hadn't heard it through the Olympus Inc. rumor mill, she never would have guessed Monique was Aphrodite's daughter. "Sorry I'm late." Candy pressed her knees together, braced her thighs, and lowered herself onto a turquoise beanbag. "The baby was fussing and..." Candy stopped her recitation of the hectic morning. Why share that Jim had been detained in the bathroom and couldn't help with Titus when Candy was ready to leave? Monique smiled sympathetically. Candy wondered if she had children of her own. "Coffee?" Candy looked toward the barista station. "A double skinny mocha? They make good ones here." Monique singled the young woman behind the counter. Candy's red nails, damn, one of them was chipped, drummed the tabletop. "I'm a little nervous about this, but it's time, don't you think?" Monique extracted a glossy catalog from her briefcase. "I know marriage and the media is a huge success, but don't you think it's time to, well," Monique raised an eyebrow, "spice it up a little?" Candy's face grew hot. Advance reviews of the forthcoming M&M book, Deep Marriage, were good, but she dreaded presenting the companion seminar series. It was also psychological. The overall tone reminded her of the workshops Jim led at employee retreats. There was no fun in the formula. Monique slid the catalog toward Candy. The cover image was a headshot of Aphrodite, a finger held to her hot pink lips as if to keep a naughty secret. "What I'm thinking," Monique said as she flipped to a bookmark page, "is something like this." The colorful spread touted Fantasy 4-2 gift bags, complete with costumes, character descriptions, and suggested scenarios for love play. "Low-carb aphrodisiacs included," she said as Candy studied the page. The barista delivered their mochas while Candy read the description of the Arabian Nights fantasy gift bag, then one called Corporate Dream. The themes reminded her of something. She turned a few more pages, 50 themes in all. "Hey," she looked up at Monique, "the gift bags are modeled on the theme rooms in Aphrodite's mansion." Monique smiled. "It's her new product line. When she quit doing personal counseling sessions at the mansion, I wasn't about to let all the theme research go to waste." Candy caught the point, though her mind was divided between Monique's explanation and the Pirate Island gift bag. Jim would look hot in an eye patch. Advanced copies of Deep Marriage had already gone out, but maybe an appendix could be added before it went to final press? It's a lot to think about, Candy said, though she felt like shouting, what a great idea! She pitched the concept to Hera when they met later this week. But how in heaven and earth would she persuade Hera to go for it if Aphrodite would benefit?
I was a bit troubled by all these gods because they didn't seem very godly to me. They seemed actually just like the rest of us, intrigues and jealousies and revenge. And I mean, I would expect more of gods than all of that.
Well, they do a lot of work too, but honestly, that's why the Olympian gods in particular have endured through the millennia. It's because they are so much like us. They were created to look after us, and their existence depends on our existence. That's why climate change has become so critical to them. It's an existential threat for them too, if we take ourselves out. But no, they're very human. The big G's and the small G's included, they've got their jealousies, their intrigues. They break the law. They occasionally get hung over.
And they live a very long time, whatever live means.
Yes. And in fact, that's something that they age about one of our years for every 100 years. So it's really unclear to me and to them as well if they really are immortal or if they're just incredibly long-lived. I think the oldest character that shows up in the book is 7,000 years old.
And it's clear that Zeus himself especially is showing significant signs of age.
Yes, well, he's 6,400 now. Hera's a little older. She's 6,600. David's waiting for his 21st 100th birthday. There, if you heard that, you might get a clue as to what happens to him.
I was wondering how old they have to be to be eligible for Social Security.
Well, I don't think they need it.
So they have family money.
They do. Yes. Well, you know, if you've been around a long time and if you keep it all in the family, it tends to build. I mean, that's kind of the whole argument for marriage, isn't it? The creation of children and the preservation of wealth.
I have never heard that before. The preservation of, the creation of children, I understand that part. It's sometimes the creation of children and the preservation of wealth can be at odds with each other. But Susan Mattely, this has been a good evening. Thank you for talking about your books. How do people find your books?
Well, I have a website, and it's easy to find. It's SusanDMattely.com. The D stands for Denise, so Susan D. Mattely. I write as S. D. Mattely. That's a convention of the genre. When I first started putting my books out there, it was true at the time anyway, that if you were a female fantasy mythology writer, there might be a little bit of negative prejudice against you, like a man writing a romance novel.
So that's like in telephone books. When there used to be telephone books, women would just list their first initial and their last name until everybody who wanted to cause trouble knew that if you wanted to bug a woman on the telephone, you just looked for first initials. And no, I have not done this, by the way, but first initials.
Oh, sure, Phil.
Well, I thought by now you would trust me. Susan, it's been a pleasure. And we'll read your books and look forward to two more.
Well, thank you. I have a great deal of fun writing them. And for people who enjoy my writing, I do have a weekly blog at my website. In fact, this week's blog was number 350. So I've been putting up one a week pretty much since March 2015.
And your blog, in fact, has, I was going to say, multiple personality disorder. It actually may be order, multiple personality order. There's three of you in this blog.
Yes. After Bruce died, I think like a lot of people who lose their spouse, you go through kind of a shift in your identity. And after about 6 months, I started thinking, well, who am I outside of my relationship with Bruce? And the person who was the most fun that I landed on was my inner 14-year-old. And so I gave her a name. Her name is Lily. And Lily is very real to me. Lily got piano sheet music for Christmas and some Icelandic dark chocolate. And then about a year after Lily came along, Nine showed up, who is my inner 9-year-old. She's totally different. Lily is very theatrical and very skinny and very, very adult feeling. And Nine is kind of a foodie. And Nine comes from the year 1968. And the biggest, most traumatic event of her young life was when they did a straw poll for the 1968 presidential election in Mrs. Morton's fourth grade, and Nixon won. And she just, that was a bitter pill for Nine, because she was a serious Humphrey supporter.
Well, Susan, I imagine you will reconcile all these people on your blog. Your blog is entertaining, just like your books are.
Oh, thank you.
You're very welcome. Let me try to rack my brain for what I was thinking about your blog. Oh, I know what it was. One more question. Make it brief, because I want to play one bit of music before I go away. The internet is not the friend of many a writer, mm-hmm. right? I mean, people are not buying books. They're looking at books online, and they're not looking at books at all. They're just looking at their computer or their games or what have you. It seems to me you have used the internet very much to your advantage.
Well, I try to. The books are offered as ebooks through the dread Amazon, for one thing. I prefer doing the in-person events, the readings and the book signings. And I'm actually giving a presentation this next November that's called Myth Taken Identities, the Greek Pantheon in Fiction. So that should be fun. I'd love to do more writers' conferences and things like that. But, so much of it is online now. The last three writers' conferences I've attended have been virtual conferences. So it just, it seems to go more with the flow of where we are with the pandemic now. But, my ebook sales are often stronger than my print book sales. And I think a lot of people prefer the portability of ebooks. So as long as they're paying royalties and, people aren't stealing my work, I guess I'm okay with it. And I do use my website and my blog to
listen. The people who are listening and not watching you on Zoom didn't see you grimace when you said that. Susan Matley, thank you very much. I got to go away now.
Thank you so much, Phil. I sure appreciate the opportunity. And it's just been a lovely evening. Thank you.
You take care of yourself.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.